Good morning and welcome, everyone. My name is Sherry Hills, and I'm the Acting Manager of Research at the Ontario Media Development Corporation. Thank you for joining us. I'm sure most of you know about the OMDC, but for those who don't, we are an agency of the Government of Ontario. Our mandate is to stimulate employment and investment in Ontario's creative media industries and to help build strong companies in Ontario that can compete on the world stage. OMDC offers programs and services for the film, television, magazine, book, IDM, and music industries. This morning's topic is diversifying audiences and revenue streams through live events. We've seen some great examples recently of companies who've used their books, games, magazines, TV shows, and films as jumping-off points to create novel experiences. These experiences allow content creators to get up close and personal with their audiences in non-traditional ways. Our panel today promises to share insights and some of their tips for success. We're pleased to have Heather Canaby from Word on the Street Book and Magazine Festival here to moderate our panel. Our industry panelists today are Meredith Braun from Digital Extremes, David Leonard from the Walrus Foundation, and Mark Montefiore from New Metric Media. I'll leave it to Heather to introduce them properly in a moment. Our moderator, Heather Canaby, is an arts manager with over 15 years' experience working with cultural and corporate partners. Heather joined the Word on the Street in 2013 as festival director. Before that, she was project manager with an events firm in Dubai, producing large-scale marketing activations for clients including Lexus, Ford, and Nokia. Prior to her MBA, she was the programming and business affairs manager at Women in Film and Television Toronto, where she developed an annual program schedule of over 600 hours of professional development training. Please join me now in welcoming Heather Canaby. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm really excited to have such a great panel here representing kind of every aspect of the cultural industries. And I kind of made my own change to the title of the discussion today because I don't think these kind of events are necessarily all about diversifying audiences. So I've changed it to cultivating audiences and diversifying revenue streams. And without further ado, I'm going to introduce my wonderful panelists, starting with Meredith Braun, who's the VP of Publishing at Digital Extremes. From the early 80s, when she saw the dashes crossing the playing field of the Coleco head-to-head football handheld to having the numb thumb from holding onto the Atari 2600 controller for too long, learning the jumping patterns to Pitfall, Meredith Braun has been hooked on video games. Now a games industry veteran with over 18 years, Meredith Braun has been integral to Digital Extremes' growth as an independent video game developer. Recently, she ushered Digital Extremes into the world of publishing, building the side of the business from the ground up to launch and support its free-to-play hit Warframe, along with their recently announced new game, Keystone, and, of course, all the future growth to come. Next, we have David Leonard, who's the director of events for the Walrus Foundation and the founding producer of the Walrus Talks, which has become one of the most respected ideas-based events in Canada, and has brought hundreds of Canadians' brightest minds to the Walrus stages from coast to coast to coast. Prior to that, he did communications and campaign work for a number of national environmental charities, and before that, spent almost a decade as a publicist for some of the most well-known authors and publishers in Canada and around the world. And now we move on to Mark Montefiore. Did I say that properly? Pretty close? Okay. Who is the co-president and executive producer at New Metric Media. He was named The Hollywood Reporter's Next Generation Under 35 in 2014, so I'm not sure where that stands. And Playback's Top 10 to Watch in 2012. Mark is the executive producer of multiple Canadian Screen Award-winning best comedy series Letterkenny for Crave TV and What Would Sal Do, also on Crave TV. Montefiore also produced the Whistler Film Festival and TIFF Film Circuit Audience Choice-winning feature film Cass and Dylan, starring Academy Award winner Richard Dreyfuss and Emmy Award winner Tatiana Maslany. So please join me in welcoming our panelists this morning. since events are a big part of our lives, I thought it might be useful to kind of go back to the textbook and look at what we're actually talking about today, which is live events and experiences. So these can be defined as company-sponsored activities or programs designed to create brand-related interactions. That's very clinical, but I think it helps kind of frame our discussion today. So for the most part, I see these events in tandem with social media as something that companies are really going to target niche markets and cut through the clutter of traditional marketing. So firstly, we see this as a marketing communication tool, kind of hopefully cultivating audiences and looking at future revenue. But also, I think our panelists can speak to how these events can create revenue of their own. So that's certainly not off the table. I know working at Women in Film and Television, working at The Word on the Street, we worked with a lot of different partners, and one of the first things we did before initiating an experience at the event was really understanding what their motivation was. Why are they getting into this, and what were their kind of key performance indicators? So number one, that's to make sure we aligned in terms of our mandate, but also so we could kind of deliver ultimately on what they were expecting. So if each panelist can kind of go through and give me a rundown on what kind of live events you've done, what motivated you to start doing those, and what were your kind of key performance indicators? Shall we start with Mark?
Sure, okay. I'm a bit jet lagged, so excuse me if none of this makes any sense. With Letterkenny, it's started as a web series as 5 2-minute videos that went on YouTube back in 2013. And that was around the same time that I started our company with my business partner, Patrick O'Sullivan. And we saw that and we fell in love with it right away. There was maybe about 300,000 or 400,000 hits on those videos at the time. And we just fell in love with it. We connected with it creatively and whatnot. So we met with the creator, Jared Kiso. And we saw from the very beginning that Letterkenny had a lot of tentacles of where it could go and that it could reach far. And from our initial conversation we always talked about, you know, there's the book opportunities, there's a live tour, there's feature film, there's merchandise, there's all sorts of different things that would stem from a TV show. And now, 3 years later, we're in production on our third season that will bring us up to a total of 33 episodes at the end of this season. And we're starting to realize a lot of these different opportunities that we hoped for and we saw from the very beginning. Today's actually a really interesting day in the life of Letterkenny because we're launching our first ever Puppers beer. It's a real beer that you can buy at the LCBO starting today all over Ontario, or select LCBOs anyway. So the orders are still coming in from all of them, but there's a lot of different places that you can get them at. And so how that started was in our first season we had OV was a beer of Letterkenny. That was our first beer, and we, you know, Molson and whatnot. We had all dressed chips, so we really were catering to products that already existed. And from there, we went to the second season. We're like, you know, why are we doing this? These guys aren't giving us any money, so why are we? You know, it started as a you know, there's some YouTubers, some tweets that Jared would send out that about being Canadian, all dressed chips and sitting by the barbecue having an OV that really took off. So we wanted to embrace that Canadiana out of it. And that worked. But then we saw, we're like, well, why don't we have our own beer? So season two, the writers started writing in Puppers, which is a dog on a beer can. And there's a lot of dogs in Letterkenny if you haven't seen the show. So Puppers, we decided to create that fake beer within the world of Letterkenny. And from there, audiences started asking about the beer and started asking, you know, when can we get it? So this year, this season, we partnered with Stack Brewing in Sudbury to be able to have a real beer. So it's a tall boy can, tastes real good, easy drinking. I know. I got 8 cases delivered to the office yesterday. I haven't been in the office. I just arrived from Rome last night. So I haven't picked them up yet. Now, hopefully somebody put them in the fridge. So today we're having an event. You're all invited, by the way, 5 to 7, Dog and Bear and Queen West. It's a Queen and Dover Court. Some of the cast will be there, some autographs. So this is part of the live. I'm getting to the live thing. I'm getting there, I promise. So This is a fan event that we're doing this afternoon where a cast will be there. They'll have an opportunity to purchase merchandise, purchase the beer. You can get a litter of puppers for $15, and that's three cans. It's an opportunity for them to be able to experience the world of Letterkenny with the cast. But as far as the actual live experience goes, this is an offshoot that we're just doing now to launch the beer. But really what we've done is, and what we're working towards, is after we shot the first block of the last season in February in Sudbury, our show shoots all in Sudbury, we want to test out and see if there was an audience for a live show, because we've been getting a lot of requests for our cast to show up to DJ nightclubs or to introduce a band or that kind of stuff. They went out to Stampede. Two guys went to Stampede last year in Calgary, and they were paid quite handsomely to show up for an hour to a nightclub and just welcome the crowd. And it got people in the door, and we sold some merchandise, and we saw a big opportunity with that. So we thought, okay, well, how can we do this that we can control it and not just have random bars asking for the cast to come? Because you never really know what's going to happen with that. It's kind of hit or miss with those appearances. So we decided, we had the cast in Sudbury. We wrapped production on a Thursday night, and we decided we were going to do a live show, which was the tester show that we did. It was a 75-minute show that incorporated original sketches, some new sketches between the cast. We had a cast of five there. We didn't have the full cast, but we had a cast of five. We had original videos that hadn't been seen before that we had shot in production. Those were 2 or 3 minute sketches as well. And then we had stand-up comedy from some of our cast. So that comprised about 75 minutes. We didn't have an intermission, which we will have going forward. You can sell a lot of merchandise and beer during intermissions. And that was pretty much the gist of it. So from that, we sold 750 tickets. We sold out the venue in Sudbury in a matter of about 3 or 4 days. So with that, we then turned around and we went out to all the major promoters in North America. And we had them come in and pitch. We had five of them ultimately come and pitch us a live tour across Canada starting and then ultimately across North America. So we're in the process of closing that deal right now, which we'll be announcing very soon. But it's going to start with a 30-city tour across Canada in the early 2018.
So this would be off time from production?
It would be off time. The idea would be that we keep the cast engaged all the way as much during the year as possible. This year we shot 20 episodes, or we're in the process of shooting 20 episodes. But because of the writing schedule and we have a limited writing team, we've broke it up into three blocks. So we shoot 6, 7, and 7. So 6 shot February, 7 in July, that we start shooting on Tuesday, and then 7 in October. So in between that, it's very difficult to do much. But going forward, we're looking at combining the production schedule and just doing it in one block with a small hiatus in between. And that frees up the cast to be able to do these things like appearances. The appearances will fill in the gaps, but the live tour really would take up the majority of the time in between production schedules.
So would your KPI be more engagement, or are you making enough money off these events that this is kind of a subsidiary revenue stream for you?
Originally, we thought it was just going to be purely, it didn't look like it was going to be a moneymaker. It's just a fan engagement kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But now we're starting to see the opportunities where it can come from. And one of the things that we're looking at, for instance, it's everything kind of feeds itself. So we're talking about who's going to be the title sponsor for the Letterkenny Tour. And you know, unless somebody shows up with a $1 million check, it's going to be Puppers. You know, Puppers beer will sponsor the live tour, and then at those events, you'll be able to buy Puppers as well. That'll be the exclusive beer at those certain venues and whatnot. So there is a real opportunity to be able to make some money from it, and that's the way we're looking at it. You know, it's definitely the fans will be having an amazing experience. First and foremost, that is the goal, give the fans a great experience, and if we can make a few bucks from it, then that's a secondary goal.
Great. So, David, you were also the initiator of this.
Sure, yeah. So The Walrus, as you hopefully all know, was primarily a magazine. It's also a charity with an educational mandate. And what we try and do everywhere that we work is start conversations. So, I'll do a little bit of audience interaction here. How many people here subscribe to any magazine at all that comes to your house in your mailbox? Yeah, like about half. Print is changing, and we knew this. So, you know, as we were developing from being just a magazine to do other things, we thought, well, how are we gonna build some tentacles and reach into some other places. So originally the events were largely promotional with the goal to, you know, launch parties for magazines, sponsored book launches, that kind of thing. The goal was really to engage the audience that we had, but not really to meet new people. Quickly, we realized there's an opportunity here to take this magazine brand and blow it up and make it much bigger, because ultimately we're a charity, and nowhere in our charitable letters does it say we actually even have a magazine. So the magazine is just something we do and will always do, but it was a chance for us to say, well, let's actually use the full letter of our incorporation and be the thing we want to be. So I came on during a time where we were doing some events, and my job was to come in and sort of create an events program that not only engaged our existing readers, but also acted as an audience development tool. So reading a magazine, it can be a very solitary experience. You might write a letter to the editor, you might tweet or Facebook something about the piece you've just read, but it's largely solitary. And because our mandate's the conversation, we were trying to find some way to really engage in a more deep way with the audience at large. So naturally, public events are one of the most engaging because you are in someone's face talking to a single person. So we did debates for years, which were fine. They were okay. And then we started seeing those sponsorship opportunities. So along with stretching the content, stretching the mandate towards the issues we care about, which is the big issues that face the future of the country, end quote, we also saw that sponsors were attracted to the kind of people that were attracted to us. So Walrus readers, Walrus audience are curious, they're educated, they're generally urban, they generally are, if not affluent, then certainly on their way. It's an audience that's appealing to a lot of sponsors. So we started looking for sponsorship for these events while also making sure to keep the core strength of the Walrus at our hearts, which was editorial independence, fact-based, journalistic, well-researched, not from any particular perspective, but a forum for lots of different perspectives. So debates happened for a couple years. They were fine. But then I quickly realized that the problem with the debate is that you have two perspectives in a debate. And very few conversations that are of consequence in this country are binary. There's very few people that can actually, it's a black hat or a white hat, it's a yes or a no. So the Walrus Talks was born just out of nothing. We did a prototype in 2011, and we launched the first one in 2012. And the format is 8 speakers, 7 minutes each, on a stage, no Q&A, no panel, and you say to yourself, wait, what about the conversation? It's always followed by a reception afterwards. And the reception is for everybody. It's not a VIP thing. And what we found is that the fast-paced content by people of consequence, I mean, the people who have been on our stage is everyone from the most well-established writers, thinkers, scientists, politicians you can think of, to the 15-year-old performance poets and emerging youth, you know, from all walks of this country, you know, diversity in all of its forms. And these speakers are mixing with the general public and our VIP guests, who are those same people who are attracted to sponsors. So the way it works for us now is it's bringing people to the conversation rather than bringing people to the magazine. So if we're doing a conversation about arts and culture, then generally in our polling, about half of the people who come to that talks are existing magazine subscribers or magazine readers, and about half the people who come are new to the Walrus brand entirely. So it's an audience development tool for us. The reason it's successful in terms of audience is that it really tries to be part of these conversations that are already out there. We know that people are talking about energy. We know that people are talking about arts and culture. We know that people are talking about reconciliation. So let's make our place a centerpiece of that conversation. And because the people that we get are curious and engaged and thoughtful, you actually get this conversation. And then, of course, once they come to one thing, a Walrus Talks, then we try and make them come to everything else. Now you maybe become a subscriber, or maybe you become a donor, or maybe you become some other type of stakeholder with us. The other side of this, of course, is that sponsorship has grown as the series has grown, and it now represents something like 40% of the overall revenue of the place is sponsorship revenue from the Walrus Talks, which has allowed the Walrus other platforms, magazine, website, to really take more risks and to flourish more by hiring more artists, more writers, more producing more content that, again, furthers the goal of that conversation. So our key measurements, my key deliverable is money, but my other key deliverable is content. And so to try and actually have conversations on stages that reflect the true diversity of this country on the major issues that are facing this country. And if we do that on stages 30 times a year from coast to coast to coast, then not only are we collecting a national conversation, but we're also making a lot of impact in those markets where the talks pop up.
So clearly the KPIs change as these events develop.
In the early days, the goal was more people know what the Walrus is. And I still think, I'll be honest, that in this room, I would even say there's probably people who are not that familiar with the brand. It stands for lots of things that people care about, and it stands for journalism and integrity, and it stands for an intellectual rigor. But in the early days, it was like getting people to know there is a thing called the Walrus, and it also has a magazine. But now that word is much more out there, the goal really is, can this thing be a financial driver? And then also, can it bring in voices that we don't often hear in the usual media landscape? And so this is not, people that look like me. And it's not, when you look at something like Peter Mansbridge retiring yesterday, God love Peter Mansbridge, a true national icon. But I looked at some pictures of the party that they had for him. And I would suggest that our stages look a bit different than that. Yeah.
Great. Thank you, David. Meredith?
Hi. I think I may need to give a little bit of background on Digital Extremes and what we do. I might be the lone wolf here in the video game industry today. Anyone here from video games? Hey, yay. My people. So we've been around for almost 25 years now, and we've obviously then gone through the cycles of different generations of video game platforms and things like that. We make high-end kind of immersive experiences for the PC, Xbox, and PlayStation platform. And over the course of the last 5 years, we have kind of claimed our independence from being a work-for-hire studio and decided to go out on our own and make the dream project that had been sitting on our shelves for 12 years that nobody else wanted to publish. And so that turned into Warframe. And we had zero budget to start from in terms of marketing. So it was myself and a community manager that we hired who essentially kind of hit the ground running with social media, talking to our players, any player who would come into it. Our game is digital download only, so you grab it online and or on your console, and then come to visit us on our website and talk to us there. The game's culture, I guess, is why we started to think about live events. Warframe took off bigger than what we ever had dreamed it might. We're over 30 million players now around the world in 17 different languages. And similar to Comic-Cons or other kind of big fan events, these players just want a human interaction with the kind of hobby or fandom that they're interested in participating in, and being around all of the other people who are interested in that same thing. So we didn't think that we were a little worried that people might not come to London, Ontario, to visit us for our very first fan-only event for Warframe last summer, and we ended up selling out, which was great, at over 1,200 people, and they came from all over the world, which was really surprising. Japan, Australia, lots of Europeans, the U.S., of course, and our goal from the beginning was kind of this human emotional connection that humanizes our development team, because our game is a constantly updating game. So it isn't a game that you buy off the store shelf, and once you have it, it's done, you finish it, and you remember what a good time you may have had with that game, but it's done after you've completed everything in it. Our game is perpetual, so we call it Games as a Service, and we update and add content to it about every 2 months. And so constantly bringing back the audience is a big factor for us. And so adding the live events was a retention strategy for us, as well as kind of education on game development. We made, you know, just a big day about how Warframe is made, any sort of real-life activities that we could gamify for Warframe itself, and also just start to meet our fans in person. We interact with them online on a daily basis. We live stream with them. We've kind of humanized our development team to them. They've become kind of mini celebrities to our fan base. And a side effect that we weren't really expecting from our day is a team morale boost from our own dev team. So most of them are behind the scenes, and they're not necessarily realizing all the lives that we're touching with the experience that people are having with our game. And we get all kinds of, you know, really interesting human stories of you know, to the point where people are writing to us about the pain management from an injury they had in a war that they were in, because they're in the military, and they're saying Warframe is, you know, helping them mitigate the amount of meds that they have to take every day because it takes their mind off their pain. Or, you know, we've had people meet through Warframe and get married. So we actually held an online wedding last year in Warframe, and we officiated, and they forewent a physical wedding. Everybody came to the online wedding, including all of the Warframe fans. So
who needs live events, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. So we wanted to bring this into the physical, and that's why we started. And what we call it is TennoCon, because the name of kind of, or the race of being that you are in Warframe are called Tenno, and so we weren't really out there to necessarily. We didn't think it would be a revenue builder for us, although it's starting to turn in that direction. Our second event is next Saturday, but it was more about just interaction with our fans, really building our White Knights. You know, those champions who will then proliferate the word of mouth out there to continue, you know, building the brand for Warframe around the world. Merch sales we've started, of course. And then there was a charitable element for us. Digital Extremes is a company. We've always kind of prided ourselves on being very involved in our community and trying to give back where we can. And so 100% of our ticket sales from last year went to a charity that we chose. So next Saturday is our next big one. We've sold out again. This year we've doubled the size. We're at over 2,500 people, and I think we may have outgrown the London Convention Center, so we may consider moving out of London and into a bigger city, easier to travel to, that kind of thing. But we do like the intimate nature of how we get to interact face-to-face with our fans so easily in that setting.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, I think both Meredith and David kind of spoke to audience development, and that leads me, I guess, to my next question. I know on the corporate side, I worked with Mini, for example, and one thing they noticed through audience segmentation was that most of the people that buy Minis are people that own Minis. So certainly when they started to create live events and driving experiences, it was very much around knowing what audience they were looking at for their event. So maybe, David, you can speak to that in terms of knowing which audiences you kind of were going for.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit tough for us because we have an audience of curious and engaged Canadians, which is like everybody should be, right? But we've done a lot of demographics on our audience, and you know, the magazine readers, as I say, are urban, affluent, educated, you know, curious people. But events-wise, I mean, really, we keep ticket prices very low and deliberately very low because we want it to be as inclusive as possible. But we also want to make sure that we're gathering people who are curious and engaged and thoughtful no matter where they are in their career or life arc. So it's a bit of a tough, it's sort of more of a psychographic than a demographic that we collect. But the type of person that's coming to our event is the type of person who wants to engage in their community in some way. They want to engage in the issues that we bring to the table. And those issues are constantly changing. So every event that we do, whether the topic is energy or reconciliation or philanthropy or sport or whatever it is, you know, we're gathering a different makeup of the crowd, but what unifies them is this sort of curious, thoughtful engagement. So audience development really is we do all of our promotion for these events in the places where these people already are. In a way, you bought a mini, you have a mini, you know, and these people are reading newspapers and they're listening to CBC and they're engaging in their local, you know, ward newsletters and they're going to public events. And so we work hard to find those people who are actually really engaging on these issues and bring them to our events. Because ultimately what they offer is we sort of act as a convener for these conversations. So whether it's the magazine or the website or the talks, people look around in the reception after the event and they've just had, you know, I sort of cast it off. They've just had an hour of great content, obviously, because that's what we do. But then the reception afterwards, they look around and they see their fellow people and they see the other engaged, curious, thoughtful people. And we sort of created these networks and communities across the country who see themselves reflected in the event and see themselves reflected in each other. And that's been at the absolute core of who we get and why we get them is they come because they know who's going to be there and it's going to be people like them. And I think it works the same way, like with a con. Like I want to be among my people, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Mark? Are they the diehard fans, or are you kind of looking to expand your audience?
You know, for us, it's we're still at quite an infancy with Letterkenny. We really are still figuring out who the audience is, because as soon as we kind of feel like we know what it is, this whole other audience just shows up. That's, for instance, okay, when we first started on our YouTube videos, it was predominantly like 80% of our hits. We could track those by who was watching YouTube. YouTube gives some great analytics. It was 80% men between 19 or 18 and 34. That was our core demo. And then we got onto the TV show. It was really tough to analyze that because Crave's analytics stream wasn't... It wasn't as effective as you would think at the beginning because it was a new system for them, new platform for them as well too. So it was really by credit card. So whoever had the credit card. So if it was a man or a woman in the household that had a credit card that was 50 plus, but it was their kids watching the show, we really couldn't figure out exactly who that was. So it was really just by postal code and by who the subscriber was. So that kind of threw us for a little loop, but we're starting to get that information now. And then we got to the live show and we did a pop-up shop on Queen Street a couple of months back. Seeing the people that walked through the door and buying stuff, it was a mixed bag completely of all ages and diversities. And we're, you know, I think what you were saying earlier about the psychographics, that really for us is, I think, is more accurate to us. It's real Canadiana. And that's what we're seeing more so than who the person is, what their philosophies and beliefs are. And that's where we feel like we're starting to understand our audience a bit more. And also within the show, too, there is three different distinct groups. There's the Hicks, there's the hockey players, and there's the Skids. And even with those, they each have their own following. You know, when Crave promotes a show and for our live show, really promoted going towards hockey towns and arenas and that kind of thing, which is amazing because that is a strong part of our audience. But there is a whole other side that we haven't been specifically directing towards, and that's the small town, farm community kind of Mark's Work Warehouse type audience, you know, that we haven't really been going for. So it's we really are learning on a day-by-day basis. I think we could be doing a lot more on our end to figure that out exactly, but we do feel it's wider than we think it is. So
it's great. I know in all of my studies and things, certainly listening and learning from audiences is a big part of what the purpose of these kind of live events are. Considering the types of platforms that you have, Meredith, how do you kind of collect that information, or how do you listen to the audiences?
You know, it's kind of across the board. We have official forums that we run, all of our social media channels, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. We have an active and large group within internally that keeps track of those things on a daily basis and interacts in as human a way as possible as we can. Also, our we have a customer support department that, you know, has to manage any of the, you know, issues that arise with players who run into problems with the game. And so that's another connection that we have with our players.
So how does that play into the event itself? Like, how do you kind of listen then with those things at the event itself?
Well, we kind of take all those learnings from, last year was our first inaugural year, so we've learned some lessons from last year as well, and all the feedback came in from all those channels, and we've grown it to be much more diverse even this year with the activities that we're offering. For instance, you know, many of our audience wanted to know, well, how do I get a job at Digital Extremes? So this year we're having a panel on how to get into the games industry and what are all of the different jobs that are, you know, avenues of getting into the games industry, that kind of thing. We realize that, you know, even though our audience plays our game, some of the, you know, they have real lives as well. And in fact, we have hired people from our fan base at this point. Also, just because you get such interaction from them. They're sending in fan art. We have bands who have made music about Warframe. There's tattoos on people that are questionable. it gets a little bit... it's really impressive. So we take all that feedback from all of those different spots, and it goes right back into... our event planning, which I think is probably another question, but we do all of the planning internally because we know our product best, we feel, and we get some outside help for, you know, kind of the logistics type of thing, but in terms of like decor and AV help and that, but all the programming for our live event we put together ourselves.
Excellent. I think you were speaking a little bit earlier about social media and how that kind of plays into your listening in just now as well. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about how social media is incorporated into the event itself?
Yeah, actually, while we're at the event, we're live tweeting. So we have someone dedicated to just keeping all of the people who aren't there physically in the know on what's happening. So with lots of pictures, lots of... video that we'll post to Twitter and Facebook throughout the day. And then at the end of the day, we actually run an hour-long live stream, kind of a, you know, almost a The View type on-the-couch situation with cameras where we're kind of interrogating our development team on what's coming out for Warframe next and getting the audience leaving on a high note with the big features that will come in the game down the road, similar to like all of the Marvel movies that, you know, give sneak peeks at the Comic Cons and get the fan base really riled up. That's what we end our event on.
Okay, I know we're supposed to move along to question and answers now, but maybe very, very quickly, each of you, since you had this question in advance, can tell me, what's your revenue generation breakdown from your event? So sponsorship, ticket sales, on-site sales, those kind of things. Did you write down your answers?
I did, actually. We're about 50-50. We're 50-50 on tickets versus merchandise sales. Actually, let me see. I think I did write it down. And then the number of people is over 2,500, which is much smaller than these guys over here, but we're hoping to continue to grow it.
We are percentage-wise, I mean, sponsorship is like 90% of all the revenue of these events. The ticket price for us is largely a rounding error. And the reason it is that way is we use the tickets as a tracking mechanism. Free events, people will show up to or not, and they have nothing at stake. So we charge, like I say, a very small price for a reason. But because we charge that small a price, it ends up being, you know, like I say, 5%. The business bounce on other platforms, whether it's magazine or advertising or whatever else, is a bit harder to track. But I would say if I had to do numbers, I'd say, you know, 90% sponsorship revenue, probably 8% revenue bounce to other platforms, and probably 2% tickets.
Since we've only done the one event so far, it's can only project as to what we're looking at from all the numbers we've been running. Looking ahead, from straight ticket sales, that's like base tickets. We're looking at probably about 50%. Then there's a VIP packages. So the way we structure it is, there's a base ticket that gets you into the event. If you buy a VIP ticket, that's a meet and greet with the cast, photo op, autograph, sit in the first 10 rows. That's a premium ticket price on top of that. And then there's the merchandise. So we're looking at probably around 50% for regular tickets, 25% for VIP, and 25% approximately around for merchandise.
Okay, great.
Similar.
Okay.
We tier our tickets similarly. Yeah.
Great. Question over here?
Yes.
Sorry, here comes the mic.
Hi. I'm Lucy, a question from Mark. So you get your cast quite involved in those events. How does it change your contractual agreements with the cast if it has an impact?
We pay them much more money. Yeah. I mean, how does it change the contract? You know, we have to... Right now, we've been dealing with separate contracts. There's a TV show, and then there's on a case-by-case event basis. So we're in the process right now of figuring out, is there an overall type thing, or is it still a piecemeal, keep those separate? There's benefits to both. We haven't identified which one is more beneficial just yet, but in my view, it's always the simpler the better. So if there's one contract that deals with everything, great.
Was there someone in the back there on this side? No? Okay, right here.
Matt, a question for Meredith. Did you have a tournament when you had your event, and do you anticipate a future for the esports market in Canada?
Yeah, absolutely. So we did. There was an area, a play area that we set up with PCs, Xboxes, and PlayStations as a portion of the floor space that we took up. We ran... Warframe itself isn't a competitive game, so we kind of have to make up the competition live for our events so that we can then give out prizing and things like that. But it definitely having the game there playable at the event was something that everybody expected. We also showed off new content that they didn't get to play, that wasn't out yet, so they got to play it firsthand before everybody else. And then esports-wise, our next title, which we just announced, is called Keystone, is a competitive, specific game that we are just now starting to wrap our minds around how we do the esports outreach. Esports in general is in its infancy still as well, but we certainly would like to blow it up with Keystone. Yeah.
Right here? And then we can go there.
Hi, I'm Steve Levitan, and I'm asking this as a member of the board of the city-owned theaters, so the Sony Center, St. Lawrence, Toronto Center for the Arts. I get a pretty clear idea from Mark what kinds of venues you choose for your live events, but maybe Meredith and David can give me an idea of what kinds of criteria you use to decide what physical spaces you're looking towards.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah. Ours was purely convenience. The first time around, the convention center is literally across the street from our office in London. And so it was very handy. And but I think moving forward, we're probably looking for venues that have large open space that we can kind of, you know, make our own when we show up. that have really good internet access because our games are all online. And we need that ability to live stream and take up kind of a good amount of bandwidth to do that. And kind of central, more central location. I think that, you know, we've kind of limited ourselves with the London, Ontario location in terms of traveling, especially as, you know, worldly as our audience is. It's not that easy to get to London, Ontario. It will be easier to get to Toronto. So we're certainly going to be looking at an easier to travel to location in the future.
And that's actually don't discount the laziness of audiences to travel anywhere at all.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Definitely.
Yeah. I mean, our audience likes to stay close to home, so I'm always looking for downtown venues in whatever city I'm in. Because I do events on stages, I'm looking for theaters, depending on the topic. Different topics draw different audiences, but we're maxing out around 1,800 right now, and our smallest events are in sort of the 4 to 5 range, 4 to 500. And in those venues, we're looking for any sort of, you know, all the basic technical specifications you'd expect of a theater. We want the internet, we want live stream, we want decent lights, cameras, all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we want a well-equipped professional theater with anywhere from 500 to 1,800 seats in the downtown-ish core of a major city in this country.
Easy parking?
Easy parking is always nice, too. Yeah. And we also, because of the reception, we always ask for a nice big reception space as well, which in theaters like yours would be lobby spaces or big private rooms. Yeah.
In the back.
Hi there. It's my turn. Hi, I'm Jennifer from Mars Discovery District. I have a question for all three of you. What kind of content do you package around the event? So how do you keep your audience engaged between events? Do you do newsletter content? Do you do custom content?
Oh, between events.
Exclusive content, videos.
We have a game to make. They play our game.
We make, during production for the television show, we shoot additional digital videos that get released sporadically in between seasons. We do custom videos for certain events. Sometimes they're contractual. Sometimes they're just, you know, we've released some images online for the beer that's coming out today. Jared, the creator of the show, released a custom video to promote. Wayne and Daryl are hosting a concert, a Canada 150 concert in Niagara on Sunday night. With featuring City in Color and the Strombellas and a whole bunch of other great bands. So there was a custom video that was released just for that. It's interesting because we're with Letterkenny. There was a lot of content, and it's more about trying to maintain it, but also less is more kind of approach. Mm-hmm. There was a time when we first started promoting the show. It was like on a weekly basis, we're releasing a new video, new images, new GIFs, new all sorts of stuff, and we just kind of felt like we're releasing too much. Let's slow it down a little bit. Let's pump the brakes. Mm-hmm. And we feel like that less is more approach has been working for us.
It helps build interest for when you finally do release new stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And for us, I mean, you know, we've got events across the country. So each event has its own marketing strategy, which is a combination of newsletters, advertising. But we also make a point in our other platforms, the web and the magazine, to have that topic that we're taking on in that particular event be in the magazine, on the website, in other ways. So if we're doing a Walrus Talks about video gaming, well, you know we're going to want to have some gaming content on the website, in the magazine, leading up to that to kind of establish that in our audience's eyes. And then we look into local partnerships in each market to kind of engage the audiences that are there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then after the event, the same thing. We're producing a ton of content. So we've got text, we've got video, we've got audio, all of which gets pushed out after the event. So you sort of keep this this really nice, consistent stream of content going with these peaks as the events come. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And our event is kind of a culmination of the year of content that has been put out on Warframe. It's additive to what our main revenue stream is, which is the game itself. And so our game updates, like I mentioned, very often. And so we're putting out a lot of multimedia on a very regular basis. And then leading up to the event, We kind of used the previous year's events to do a highlight reel, bloopers reel, what you're going to experience when you get here this year type thing, and lots of inside jokes and things like that on social media that only the players, you know, feel like they're in the insider knowledge know and that kind of thing.
So, David, with Walrus, do you find that your topics vary from province to province or small town to small town? And how does that impact your live presentation strategy for a year?
You know, as a national organization based in Toronto, there's always the challenge of how can you really reflect the places where you are when you're not in Toronto. We're blessed by the fact that most of the people at the Walrus are not from Toronto. We're all from all over the place. I'm from Halifax. So when we go into when we decide to do an event in the city, we do a pretty good landscape survey of what's happening and what conversations are important to those particular markets. So when we show up in Halifax doing a talk on water, we've done enough work to make sure to reflect, to feel like we're of the place, not at the place, if you know what I mean. And how does it affect? I mean, so we change topics. It's not one topic coast to coast. It's different events, one-offs across the country that we link through branding and through our own platforms. And then each of those, because they're broad enough to be a major issue facing the future of the country, we can relate back with other content in the magazine and online. Does that make sense? Yeah.
I think this gentleman was first, and then we can come over.
Hi, Alan Novak. I wanted to ask Mark, you mentioned a North America tour. So what are your strategies to take essentially a very Canadian piece of content and get it to the U.S. such that they want to show up at events?
Sure. The U.S. strategy is it's all-encompassing, all platforms, all medias for us. So our approach to that is going to be, we've got the show, we've got a live tour, we've got a brand, we've got merchandise. So we originally tried to get the show to the U.S. Around the time the first six episodes was launching. Everybody loved the show, but six episodes of a Canadian comedy, it was a little tough to be able to get a U.S. sale right off the bat there. We had a couple offers. They were not the numbers that we were hoping for, and we just believed that in due time, you know, we were well-financed. We were in no rush to or pressure to sell. So we decided, let's hold back and let's build our audience, let's build our case into the U.S., and now we've got metrics. We've got a lot of data about where our merchandise is selling. The show's not legally available there, and we've sold merchandise in every single state in the U.S., including Alaska and Hawaii. It's nuts. So with that, we have a major promoter on board now that can reach our audiences into the deep depths of Middle America. That combined with the show and all the other opportunities that we're bringing, we really see Letterkenny as a brand that's anchored by a TV show. As opposed to a TV show first and foremost. We're going to be going land, sea, and air to be able to have a strategy that comes into the U.S. all at the same time, as opposed to kind of one step at a time. So hopefully that works. We'll see what happens.
My mom says that everybody on this planet, my brilliant mom, has a problem. No matter who you are, whether you're the queen or, you know, just struggling to get by, you've got a problem, okay? Now, I'm not going to use the word problem, all right? I'm going to use the word challenge. When you guys leave here today, you're going to go back to your lives. You've just spent some time at the seminar. What is your absolute biggest challenge?
Just in life general?
Or... all right, wow.
I don't. I've lost my hair. I mean,
yeah. How about with regard to events?
To work?
Can we make it that specific?
I mean, I can speak to this quickly. I mean, the biggest challenge of a place like the Walrus, that is at its core a media brand, is that the media landscape is changing so incredibly quickly, and we're well situated to weather the storm. We've got good digital. we have a brand that stands for something in a media landscape that increasingly does not, and that helps us greatly. But I think the biggest challenge, I mean, we have, frankly, is just people's attention. I mean, I'm competing with video games. I'm competing with television. I mean, I don't see the Walrus Talks or any event that we do as competing with other events thrown by media agencies. I see myself competing with people playing Warframe and watching Letterkenny, and that's, and I think so. So my biggest challenge is always getting people's attention.
Yeah, similar for us as well. But also, I think it's managing our growth. We just can't seem to. It's growing fast. I know it's growing faster than we expected, and growing in a smart way for us is very important, so that we don't lose sight of what we started with in the first place. And the bigger you get, the harder it is to continue that kind of theme to all of those new people that you're adding at the same time. So trying to make sure that they all have enough of the Kool-Aid so that we continue down the same path is our biggest challenge, I think.
I have to... agree. That's similar challenges for us. Letterkenny's growing at such a rapid pace that opportunities are coming left, right, and center. Some are great, some are not. And it's really trying to, I think one of the challenges I have on a day-to-day basis is looking ahead and trying to keep the big picture in mind. And with keeping the big picture in mind, it's sometimes tough to not take a bird in hand when it could possibly affect something down the road. For instance, you know, we've had certain retailers approach us that want to carry some of our stock. And on the surface, it may seem great, but that could affect a bigger play that, you know, or better example is we have a distributor that wants to take, you know, Canadian rights for merchandise or so, right? And that could, and the surface could seem great. It can be a great opportunity to get it out there. But, you know, what happens when this show gets into the States and we have somebody that wants to take North American rights and now doesn't want U.S. rights because Canada is already taken or something? You know, it's like it's just being careful that maybe it's not an issue, maybe it is an issue, but it's really trying to understand all the opportunities, the pros and cons that do come with them, because we don't want to pass up something that is a bird in hand right now that may not affect us down the road for something, you know, a bigger dream that may not happen or something. Mm-hmm. And it's really trying to weigh those, but keep the big picture in mind and make decisions for today as well.
Okay. Well, big picture is, it looks like we have to wrap up now, unfortunately. So thank you so much to the audience. And, of course, thank you so much to our panelists for joining us and sharing. Thank you.
Thank you.